Responding to Urban Crisis, 1960s to 1970s. A city with two power structures, however, is like a beast with two heads. As the 1960s dawned, Los Angeles was divided in direction and torn in loyalty. Increasingly, downtown redevelopment and West Side expansion appeared as zero-sum games, with the possibility that the real leadership of the city would be wrested away by the younger and more dynamic West Siders. Moreover, the old guard restoration in City Hall under Polson was first hollowed out by increasing suburban representation on the city council, and then overthrown entirely by the unexpected victory of Sam Yorty in the 1961 mayoral election. Yorty, the most notorious perennial candidate in California politics, beat Polson by appealing histrionically to a variety of suburban discontents, ranging from trash separation, the oppression of the housewife, to overtaxation. Although inveighing against the times and the downtown establishment, Yorty, a renegade Democrat rapidly moving toward the right, had no evident connection to the West Side power structure. Rather, he won as a filibuster, exploiting an accumulation of anti-elite sentiments in the electorate. One of his many campaign pledges, directed to win votes in South Central L.A., had been to fire Chief Parker of the Los Angeles Police Department, LAPD, an avowed white supremacist held responsible by Los Angeles blacks for a police reign of terror. Instead, Yorty threw his weight behind the police and the growing white resistance to civil rights demands, exemplified by a 1964 initiative repealing California's new open housing law. A major consequence of this combination of white repression and intransigence was the Watts Rebellion of 1965. As arson fires crept perilously close to the southern edge of the CBD, and National Guard troops occupied the Social Register USC campus, downtown business leaders contemplated the possible ruin of their redevelopment strategy. If, on one hand, they confronted the McCone Commission's prediction that by 1990 the core of the central city of Los Angeles will be inhabited almost exclusively by more than 1,200,000 Negroes, on the other hand, they faced the competition of the West Side's new downtown, the Century City Complex near Beverly Hills. Nervous mortgage bankers and leasing agents started talking about a wholesale corporate defection westward, even the death of downtown. Such apocalyptic talk in the wake of the uprising of the inner city galvanized the old guard into action. As Régis Debray once put it, revolutions revolutionize counter-revolutions. According to Walton Gottlieb, Daniel Bryant of Beacons convinced Asa Call to convene a discreet steering committee of downtown's biggest corporations, known as the Committee of 25, and including Norman Chandler, Neil Petrie, Henry Salvatore, William French Smith, later Reagan's Attorney General, Norman Topping of the University of Southern California, and John McCone, who chaired the commission on the riots which whitewashed the LAPD's role and raised alarmist images of black power. The Committee of 25 was intended to function as a shadow government of the chief burghers, bringing their consensual opinion to bear upon the mayor and the council. We shall consider in a later chapter how the elite militarized downtown redevelopment in response to Watts. But this secretive group was rent by divisions over fundamental strategy. First, should they endorse the politics of racial polarization by supporting Yorty? Secondly, should the Committee of 25 be broadened to include representatives from the West Side Jewish power structure? On both scores, the Chandler dynasty, now officially led by Norman's son Otis, broke ranks with a majority of the old guard. As we saw in the last chapter, Otis's mother Buffy had long encouraged rapprochement with West Side society, a stance, incidentally, that mirrored the Times' increasing orientation to affluent groups within the entire region. Now the Chandlers, to the horror of California Club types and John Birchite members of their own family clan, joined with once-despised West Side liberals to support the unsuccessful 1969 mayoral challenge of black councilman Thomas Bradley, while the rest of the Committee of 25 backed Yorty's vicious race-baiting campaign. The schism in the downtown power structure wrought by the Times' creeping liberalization, opened the way for complex realignments. As the city languished through its first aerospace recession and third Yorty term, a group of prominent West Side Jewish liberals, led by the so-called Malibu Mafia, Max Polevsky, Harold Willens, and Stanley Scheinbaum, undertook to create a broader and more affluent support base for Bradley's rematch with Yorty. With multimillionaire Polevsky as chair of the campaign, political consultant David Garth was imported from New York to coordinate a media blitz using Hollywood stars, priests, and rabbis. Meanwhile, West Side Democratic chieftains like Paul Ziffrin, Gray Davis, and Nelson Rising tapped money sources usually reserved for crucial national or state campaigns, while a comprehensive grassroots effort was organized by liberals and black ministers. The Times hammered the final nails in Yorty's coffin with a series of denunciatory editorials. Bitter anti-Bradley forces blamed Yorty's defeat on this unholy convergence of West Side money and the editorial power of the Chandlers. In the eyes of many Central City Association types, Bradley, if not quite the Black Panther or communist decried by Yorty, was at the very least a militant and stooge for Jewish West Side democracy. A particular sore point was the new mayor's chief deputy, Maury Weiner, a talented left liberal, rumored to be a fellow traveler. Relations between City Hall and the Committee of 25 considerably improved, however, after Weiner was destroyed by a vice arrest, politically engineered by the LAPD. His replacement was Pasadena Republican Ray Remy, later head of the Los Angeles Chamber of Commerce, who smoothed communications between the mayor, rapidly showing himself to be a cautious moderate, and the downtown establishment. What eventually emerged, transcending the mass politics of Bradley's coalition between South Central and West Los Angeles, was an intricate citywide accommodation of elites. Bradley won over a hostile committee of 25 with his promotion of downtown redevelopment, rather than community developments in Watts and East L.A., as the showpiece program of his administration. Bradley supporters, who had expected democratic initiatives to address inner-city poverty and unemployment, were shocked as mayoral task forces headed by Asa Call, Philip Hawley, Broadway Stores, and Red Schnell, Prudential Insurance, set corporate-oriented economic development and transportation goals. By year three of the Bradley era, even Henry Salvatore, godfather to Goldwater and Reagan, was forking out contributions to the mayor, while the Chamber of Commerce sang the praises of an administration that it had originally denounced. The West Side power structure, which in the 1980s would take its distance from Bradley and his CBD-oriented policies, initially welcomed the new dispensation that forced downtown leaders to negotiate the city's future with them. Although the influence of the liberal Malibu Mafia rapidly faded in City Hall, their place was taken by Lou Wasserman of MCA, Ronald Reagan's agent and Hollywood's last tycoon. Bradley's role as a bridge between Los Angeles's two elite cultures was symbolized by an extraordinary 1975 fundraiser on his behalf that was jointly hosted by Wasserman and Asa Call, the Mr. Biggs of their respective halves of the city. If not a reconciliation, it was at least a consummation. The New Sprawl of Power. The black-tie elite Woodstock of the Wasserman Call dinner was also a last hurrah. From the late 1970s, the narrative of power in Los Angeles gradually ceased to be a Harold Robbins potboiler about downtown versus the West Side. Certainly such antagonisms remain, but the older social establishments have dramatically shrunk in importance as new power configurations have emerged, shaped by the extraordinary economic forces of the 1980s. The scale of the power dispersal that has occurred over the last 15 years can be illustrated by the muckraking research of Robert Gottlieb, now an eminent authority on California water, in the mid-1970s. In various pamphlets, as well as in his massive History of the Times with Irene Wolt, Gottlieb was able to draw a detailed map of how power in Los Angeles was distributed between the downtown and West Side establishments, which I have discussed in previous pages. To draw a similar power map of Los Angeles in 1990, with the same confident coordinates as a Guide to the Stars homes, is virtually impossible. We are living through a comparatively rare event, although as we have seen more common in Los Angeles than elsewhere. A genuine revolution from above, as elites are reshuffled and new power centers consolidated. Amongst the great U.S. cities, perhaps only Los Angeles, with its social porosity, spatial polycentricity, and adjacency to the Pacific Rim, is currently susceptible to such an upheaval in its higher circles. For example, there has been a dramatic increase in the number of major individual players and their mobilized wealth. Donald Bren, Marvin Davis, the Kobayashi family, Donald Trump, not to mention the fallen Michael Milken, are billionaire dealmakers who in a day's work routinely break up or assemble aggregations of capital equivalent to the entire patrimonies of old guard families. And offshore capital, not just the Japanese, but the Chinese, Koreans, Canadians, and Manhattanites as well, now have the capacity, in the context of Los Angeles's wide-open economy, to suddenly transform any scenario by huge buyouts or injections of new investments. Witness Shua's billion-dollar landing in downtown in 1976, or Trump's sudden arrival in 1990. This current volatility of power is best understood in light of what might be characterized as the post-Keynesian transformation of the Los Angeles economy. A Dickensian social polarization between rich and poor, discussed at length in latter chapters, has been the single most dramatic cause-effect expression of this transition, but three other large-scale processes are equally notable. First has been the conversion of the tract lot, the basic input of Los Angeles's major mass-production industry, into a luxury good, affordable only by a shrinking minority of local residents. Second has been the rise of a new economic geometry that is turning Los Angeles's old suburban belts into outer cities in their own right. Third has been the internationalization of the regional economy, which makes Los Angeles elites tributary to the great financial centers in Shinjuku and Lower Manhattan. How have the traditional Southern California power blocks responded to these epical changes? We still remain too much within the maelstrom of restructuring to offer a summary judgment. Instead, four brief case studies suggest some tentative theses about the relationship between old elites and new realities. First, the re-monopolization of land development. Second, the Japanese colonization of downtown. Third, the Times' attempt to regionalize its circulation and influence. And fourth, the complex combination of generational succession and foreign takeover in Hollywood. The New Octopus. For two generations between 1870 and 1910, a period that progressives regarded as California's Dark Ages, the almighty Southern Pacific Railroad, Frank Norris's Octopus, acted behind the scenes of both major parties to dictate state politics from the governor's mansion to City Hall. As Californians used to learn in school, Hiram Johnson's Progressive Revolution of 1910, which smashed the SP machine in Sacramento, was designed to prevent any private economic combination from ever again controlling the state. Yet, in the 1980s, an invisible third party emerged that recapitulates, perhaps even exceeds, the influence of the SP machine in its heyday, and which, like the octopus, operates across partisan boundaries at every level of government. This ascendant power is a re-monopolized land development industry. It is re-monopolized in the sense that urban development has been reintegrated around speculative land ownership, in a mode that differs strikingly from what was described earlier as the Keynesian suburbanization of the 1950s and early 1960s. In those days, the crucial liaison was between the merchant builder and the thrift financier. Land was relatively cheap and easily assembled from thousands of small orchard and farm owners. The supply of money, not land, was the crucial variable in determining the power structure of development. As we shall see in more detail in the next chapter, all this started changing during the Vietnam boom, as developable coastal land, the raw material of the Southern California dream, began to disappear. Resulting land inflation, which went ballistic in the late 1970s and again in the late 1980s, profoundly reshaped the distribution of wealth and opportunity. Relative land scarcity also led to a rapid decline of mom-and-pop builders, soon followed by the middle strata of developers. Control over land conversion has been increasingly centralized in huge companies capable of banking scarce remaining blocks of coastal plain or financing whole new residential or industrial cities in distant interior basins. In the Los Angeles region, this new octopus, monopolizing the development of the metropolitan edge and the infill of holes in the core, consists of three distinct, although interlocking, types of enterprise. First, a handful of great land bankers, some the direct heirs of 19th-century latifundistas, monopolize community and industrial development in southern Orange, southwestern, and northern Los Angeles counties. The Mission Viejo Santa Margarita Ranch Group, the Flood O'Neill patrimony alienated to Philip Morris in the 1970s, the Irvine Ranch, now Donald Bren, C.J. Segerstrom and Sons, whose bean field has become the postmodern downtown around South Coast Plaza in Costa Mesa, Watson Land Company, the Dominguez legacy in the Carson Zaibatsu Alley area, and the Newhall Land and Farming Company, developers of Santa Clarita and Canyon County. Second, about 15 or 20 community builders based primarily in Orange County or on the west side of Los Angeles, and including many of the key Jewish firms of the 1950s, dominate the remaining frontiers of starter homes in the Inland Empire, Western Riverside and San Bernardino counties, and the Antelope Valley. Lewis Homes, Kaufman and Broad, The Lusk Company, Goldrich and Crest, Chappelle Industries, Watt Industries, and so on. To this category should also be added the principal developers of outlying commercial and industrial centers, Cole Company, The Hagen Company, Amundsen Commercial Company, and others. Third, many members of the California Business Roundtable have discovered, in an era of skyrocketing land values and corporate rating, that their land holdings are now amongst their most valuable and liquidifiable assets. Thus, land-intensive industries have led the way to become major developers in their own right. Aerospace, Hughes Summa at Westchester and Playa del Rey, Douglas at Santa Monica and Long Beach, Entertainment, MCA and Disney in the Valley, Energy, Chevron at Ontario, and Transportation, Union Pacific at Fox Hills, and Southern Pacific in western San Bernardino County, to give a very partial list. Not surprisingly, land development is still Southern California's most lucrative large industry, with annual profit margins as high as 50%, contrasted to the 12 to 18% profits of the oil industry at the height of the last boom. The giant Irvine Ranch in Orange County, nearly five times larger than the island of Manhattan, and the largest private real estate holding in a major U.S. metropolitan area, is perhaps the best example of the wages of land monopoly. Although the ranch is an unfolding 50-year plan of private urbanization, including the utopian city of Irvine, an adjacent University of California campus, and the world's largest office and science park, it earns fabulous profits simply by leaving its rare land to age on site, like fine wine. Thus, as land values in Irvine soared an unbelievable 233% in 1988, the Irvine Company mined $630,000 in new equity from each undeveloped acre. The company's total land inflation jackpot is currently the subject of legal controversy. In 1983, the company officially declared its worth as $1 billion. Now, some real estate experts put its value in excess of $10 billion, making its owner, Donald Bren, possibly the richest person in North America, and leaving Henry George, California's 19th-century foe of land monopoly, squirming in his grave. By raising the stakes to such immense proportions, land scarcity has driven the baronial and fiercely competitive personalities comprising the upper strata of the real estate industry to unite as an interest bloc to perpetuate the political conditions of growth. On the one hand, the long-range multi-phase nature of most contemporary projects imposes the need to stabilize land use, zoning, and ensure state support for infrastructure. On the other hand, rising resistance to new development for homeowner-based slow growth movements, the subject of the next chapter, has necessitated expensive investments in organizing political counter-responses. This combination of exigencies has resulted in the creation of a vast lobbying and campaign finance network, whose supply of juice exceeds anything ever offered politicians in the days of the SP or Amundsen and Unruh. Although political journalists have frequently compared the developers' role in corrupting the current state legislature to the pre-1910 associated villainies, the favorite habitat of the new octopus is the county. This least democratic unit of government has control over land use in unincorporated growth fringes, and generally offers developers the biggest bang for their campaign buck. It is not surprising, therefore, that conservative pro-developer majorities control the boards of supervisors in every Southern California county except Santa Barbara. Los Angeles County is the most important case, if only because it is such a vast bureaucracy, traditionally overshadowing in size the city of Los Angeles, and for that matter every other local government in the country, except for New York's now defunct Board of Estimate. As the Times has frequently complained, the county is also an Ice Age throwback, lacking basic checks and balances, as well as cohesion, direction, efficiency, and accountability. Its five little kings, all white men with a 3-2-2 conservative majority, fuse administrative, legislative, and juridical authority over personal fiefdoms with populations larger than Detroit. In a typical local version of the Sacramento juice system, the political war chest of Supervisor Pete Shabarum, now retiring, was heavily endowed by 15 large developers, enabling him to transfer hundreds of thousands of dollars in the early 1980s to elect two clones, Dean Dana and Mike Antonovich, whose seats were then made impregnable with massive contributions from 30 other corporate developers. As we shall see in the next chapter, Shabarum's majority handsomely repaid developers by opening up hundreds of thousands of acres of land to subdivision that planners and citizens groups desperately wanted preserved as open space. If the land development industry is conceived as a regional or even statewide power structure superimposed on older and more parochial elites, what is particularly fascinating is the unscrupulous way in which developers' largesse nourishes conservatives and liberals alike. One of the dirty little secrets of Los Angeles politics is that Mayor Bradley, originally the standard-bearer of the most liberal wing of Southern California democracy, shares, to an astonishing extent, the same developer financial base as leading local Republicans. Thus, Irvine Company's Bren, financial godfather to Senator Pete Wilson and the largest Republican contributor in the state, has also been a major backer of Bradley, as has Richard Reardon, downtown lawyer-developer-banker, who engineered the overthrow of California's liberal Supreme Court majority in 1986. But perhaps the most revealing example of the mutual advantages of two-way political swinging is Alexander Hagen, Southern California's leading retail developer, who simultaneously shares beds with Bradley and the Republican supervisors. Through his intimate connections with City Hall, he has achieved a lucrative monopoly over the retail recolonization of South Central Los Angeles, his city-subsidized fortified shopping centers, described in Chapter 5, earn handsome returns. Meanwhile, following a friendly $29,000 campaign contribution to Supervisor Mike Antonovich, he made a cool $9 million in a few days buying and promptly reselling a former Sears Center in Antonovich's district to the County Department of Public Works. Unfortunately, these kinds of examples could be multiplied ad nauseum. They exemplify a new elite politics, which operates on a bipartisan plane, not so much because corporate developers have ceased to be ardent Republicans, but because urban Democrats like Bradley have ceased to represent the distinctive interests of popular constituencies. In California, of course, where the juice has always flowed, this is an old story. More interesting, perhaps, is the new mobility of power, whether wielded associationally or individually. From a certain historical perspective, it may be as significant that Hagen is deeply involved in the microcosm of Fontana politics, deep in the Inland Empire, as that he contributes to both sides of Los Angeles's political macrocosm. Contrasted to older, place-fixed power structures, whatever the new octopus lacks in social cohesion, it more than makes up for in regional ubiquity. Today's big developers navigate the fragmented political geography of Southern California with an ease and familiarity that would have astonished even Harry Chandler. The perils of co-prosperity. As we saw in the last chapter, Rainer Banham was not the only one to mistake the future of downtown Los Angeles. The Grand Design, an actual 1972 master plan known as the Silver Book, of the Committee of 25 and the Central City Association, has been realized under the aegis of the Bradley regime to an extent few believed possible. If there were just 5 new high-rises above the old height limitation of 13 stories in 1975, there are now nearly 50, crowned by McGuire Thomas's overweening 73-story library tower, although Donald Trump is threatening to build a 125-foot hyper-skyscraper along Wilshire Boulevard. Yet, as downtown has soared, the rising ante of speculation has forced many of the original corporate members of the Committee of 25, including large regional banks and oil companies with troubled cash flows, to sell equity and withdraw to the sidelines. Downtown, in a word, simply became too big for local interests to continue to dominate, and recentering came effectively to mean internationalization. Thus, in 1979, the Times reported that a quarter of downtown's major properties were foreign-owned. 6 years later, the figure was revised to 75%. One authority has claimed 90%. The first wave of foreign investment in the late 1970s, as in Manhattan, was led by Canadian real estate capital, epitomized by Toronto-based Olympia and York. The Reichman clan, who own Olympia and York, collect skyscrapers in the way that the merely rich collect rare stamps or Louis XIV furniture. Yet since 1984, they, along with the New York insurance companies and British banks, have been swamped by a tsunami of Japanese capital. Of all the complex factors involved in the contemporary Nipponization of the Southern California economy, 2 are particularly outstanding. First is the bizarre fact that the region's leading foreign export by volume is simply empty space. More than half the containers which arrive in San Pedro filled with computers, cars, and televisions return with nothing in them. Although it is impossible to know the regional balance of trade with any accuracy, in the mid-1980s, the state as a whole averaged $20 billion deficits in a commerce of nearly $30 billion with Japan. This one-way trade generates both the need for huge onshore infrastructures of import services, finance and sales administration, as well as mechanisms for recycling the Japanese surplus. The second factor, helping define the mode of recycling, has been the differential in land prices across the Pacific. If land inflation in Los Angeles has radically transformed the economics of local urbanization, it remains yet minuscule compared to the neutron star densities of property values in Tokyo. In face of the refusal of the ruling Liberal Democrats to plow Japan's trade windfalls into higher wages, and a Keynesian housing reflation, as demanded by the socialist opposition, trade-generated surplus capital is instead flooded into stock and real estate speculations reminiscent of Coolidge's America. What the Japanese call Zytec, the strategy of using diverse financial technologies to shift cash flow from production to speculation, began to be internationalized in the mid-1980s, with a special orientation towards Southern California. In particular, the super yen put the skyscrapers along downtown's new Gold Coast at rummage sale discounts vis-a-vis their most dowdy Tokyo equivalents. From the standpoint of the Japanese establishment, however, a noxious side effect of Zytec has been the fostering of a stratum of swashbuckling billionaires, the equivalent of our corporate raiders, known as notoria, or hijackers. It was the most notorious of the Tokyo Notoria, Shua Company Limited, who stunned LA's old guard by purchasing nearly $1 billion of downtown's new skyline, including the twin-towered Arco Plaza, in a single 2.5-month buying spree. This was the preface to what by 1990 was a bulging portfolio of 25 major Los Angeles area properties. In contrast to the polite gray flannel anonymity of other Japanese investors, Shua's boss, Shiguro Kobayashi, and his son, Takaji, have brazenly emulated the example of Amundsen and earlier generations of Los Angeles nouveau riche. In what Business Week euphemistically described as following the Japanese tradition of bringing gifts to new neighbors, the Kobayashis donated $1 million to the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in Simi Valley, contributed generously to Mayor Bradley's ill-fated 1988 gubernatorial campaign, and gave the city of Los Angeles a $100,000 down payment on the steel cloud mentioned in the previous chapter. For his part, Mayor Bradley has extended a warm welcome to the Notoria, as well as their more respectable corporate compatriots. To a greater extent than any other municipal leader, including even Atlanta's globe-trotting Andrew Young, Bradley has integrated foreign capital into the top rungs of his coalition. Although no one can recall the mayor making strenuous efforts to defend the 50,000 local high-wage manufacturing jobs wiped out by imports since 1975, he has been unflagging in his promotion of the movement of free capital across the Pacific, while denouncing critics of Japanese power as racists. His administration has kept landing fees at LAX among the lowest in the world, vastly expanded port facilities, given special zoning exemptions and development rights subsidies to foreign investors downtown, especially Shua, and made expatriate Chinese bankers the recipients of affirmative action, embroiling Bradley, in one case, in a scandal involving illegal city deposits with Henry Wang's Far East National Bank. Surprisingly, there has been little outcry from the remnants of the old guard over Japanese ownership of a third of downtown, or City Hall's tropism toward the east. With a fifth of all Japanese North American real estate investment flowing into Los Angeles, $3.05 billion in 1988 alone, major pillars of the WASP power structure have decided to join, rather than fight, this co-prosperity sphere. Following an initial phase of skyscraper trophy-taking, capped by the Shua purchases, the Zaibatsu are now in a second phase of joint venture projects with leading local developers, ranging from Mitsubishi's collaboration with Prudential to build the huge Citicorp complex downtown, to Nippon Credit Bank's partnership with Trammell Crow in City of Industry. Meanwhile, the sale of Southern California real estate is being promoted in Asia with the same fervor that it was once sold in the Midwest. Major Southland realtors like Beverly Hills-based Fred Sands are specially packaging Los Angeles property to entice the mass market of Japanese yuppies, today's Iowans. We are looking at middle-class Japanese buyers, because the middle class there often has $1 million to $2 million worth of equity in their homes. The consequence of these myriad trade flows and real estate deals, Southern California so far has only a small fraction of Japan's U.S. manufacturing investment, is the city's growing financial dependence upon Tokyo. In a few years, it may be more accurate to speak of a financial triangle of Los Angeles, New York, and Tokyo, but Manhattan money center banks have had to bide time setting up shop in Los Angeles, awaiting full interstate financial deregulation in 1991, while Japanese banks have enjoyed a spectacular head start. $50 billion in direct Japanese bank assets, led by Union Bank, are complemented by financial joint ventures like Security Pacific's wide-ranging alliance with Mitsui. Meanwhile, nearly $1 billion in county pension funds have been invested in mixed Japanese stocks, while the city issues yen-dominated bonds and parcels of downtown exchange hands entirely in yen. An obvious result of growing financial integration is that control over the Los Angeles economy is being alienated, with incalculable consequences, to power centers 6,000 miles away. The downtown renaissance, after all, is only a perverse monument to U.S. losses in the global trade war. When the Japanese economy seemed invincible and its supply of exportable capital infinite, this deficitary dialectic did not trouble local elites. But 1980's blind faith in the Pacific century began to buckle at the knees following the kamikaze dive of the Tokyo stock market in early 1990. Los Angeles's leaders were rudely awoken for the first time to the real nature of colonial subservience upon the inscrutable workings of a Japanese economy bloated with fictional capital. For example, when the Bank of Japan recently decided to raise its discount rate, it drove Tokyo investors to desert Disney Corporation's stocks en masse for domestic bonds. The result was unexpected distress and confusion in Burbank. This was an infinitesimal foretaste of what a general real estate slump in Tokyo, or a Japan-centered recession, might do to those sectors of the Los Angeles economy, like downtown or Hollywood, hopelessly addicted to ever-increasing fixes of recycled debt. The Paradoxical Times. If part of the downtown old guard has been put out to pasture while another fraction has been reduced to a satellite by offshore capital, the Times remains both the major link to past glory and the traditional institution that has tried hardest to adapt itself to the new sprawl of power. As we indicated earlier, the publishing empire's liberal turn in the late 1960s was co-resonant with its marketing shift toward the college-educated middle classes. Since the mid-1970s, the Times, self-defined as the nation's first daily news magazine, has tracked yuppie demographics across the entire girth of the Southland, from San Diego to Ventura, with specially tailored regional editions. When the rival Hearst-owned Herald Examiner finally died in November 1989 from circulation wounds inflicted years earlier in a bitter strike, the Times appeared to have triumphantly fulfilled General Otis's manifest destiny. But the Gray Lady is, in fact, plagued with problems. For one thing, Chandler Blood has continued to tire. Early in the decade, the family consigliere and former UCLA Chancellor Franklin Murphy retired, soon followed by his boss, Otis Chandler, who is rumored to enjoy surfing more than high finance. Even Missy Chandler, daughter-in-law and successor to Buffy on the arts and charity scene, has recently pulled back. This leaves fewer Chandlers at large in the city than at any time since the Spanish-American War. At the same time, the Goliath Times has been getting shellacked by newspaper Davids in critical suburban markets. The Times's original strategy in the early 1960s of simply buying out all of its regional competitors was vetoed by federal antitrust action. Now, despite enormous capital and careful planning, it finds itself on the losing end of four different regional circulation wars. In affluent, fast-growing San Diego County, it has failed to gain ground against an entrenched Copley dynasty, while in its formerly captive market of the San Fernando Valley, it barely holds its own against the upstart Daily News, owned by Jack Kent Cook, which has already crossed the Santa Monicas to compete with the Times for the blue-collar readership of the defunct Herald Examiner. Meanwhile, a regional newspaper in the making for the suburbs of the San Gabriel Valley, the Los Angeles Newspaper Network, an alliance of Pasadena, Whittier, and West Covina papers owned by the Thompson and Singleton chains, claims to have drawn even with the Times circulation and advertising revenue. But the Times's real Vietnam has been in Orange County, the land of the nation's highest median house prices, where the conservative Orange County ex-Santa Ana Register has buried a whole generation of the Chandler's best and brightest. Tom Johnson, ironically an LBJ protege, was brought in from a Texas farm team in 1980 to become Times publisher, with the specific mission of penetrating the Orange Curtain. In late 1989, after pouring tens of millions of dollars into futile marketing campaigns south of the border, he was demoted upwards. Joan Didion has revealed that the newly installed leaner, meaner regime of the 1990s, publisher David Leventhal and editor Shelby Coffey III, are widely resented within the Times as authoritarian Eastern snobs. That is, they exemplify the mercenary migration analyzed in the last chapter. But the underlying issue of these circulation wars transcends the competencies of the Times management or the competitive packaging of news entertainment. As one of the senior Times editors interviewed by Didion recognized, the paper has lost ground because of the aggressive disidentification with Los Angeles of the more recent and more uniformly affluent communities in Ventura and San Diego and Orange counties. Ironically, the once monolithically reactionary and middle-brow Times, flagship of downtown power, is now at the receiving end of a regional backlash against the cultural and political liberalism of Los Angeles's West Side. At the same time, there is also a growing suburban estrangement from Los Angeles's inverse image of being an alien third-world city. Yet the overly cautious and bourgeois Times has also had little impact upon the Latino metropolis of 3 million people within Los Angeles County. Its desultory experiments with monthly bilingual inserts have only highlighted its lack of vision and audacity. But we should not overstate the problems facing the fifth, now largely absentee, generation of the Chandler dynasty. The position of the Times as a regional power center is more paradoxical than anything else. Its increasing liberalism and catering to the highbrow have ensured its dominance over metropolitan yuppie publics, making it now as essential to breakfast with cappuccino on the West Coast as the less liberal New York Times on the East. Over the last decade, its editorial page, which for generations thundered against red menaces and socialistic public expenditures, has assumed statewide leadership in calling for a return to Keynesian budgets and social investment, precipitating thereby an acrimonious public exchange with Governor Dugmajian, an old guard throwback whom earlier Chandlers would have adored. Yet the paper is losing crucial battles to shape a truly regional super city news market, while simultaneously remaining irrelevant to the city's most rapidly growing ethnic groups. The Times's dilemma, in other words, almost precisely outlines the problem of ruling class hegemony in a postmodern city of secessionist suburbs and burgeoning barrios. Money machine in transition. In contrast to fading or colonized downtown institutions, Tinseltown's influence in local and national politics has immeasurably increased over the last generation. In an age where Republicans have reaped the major benefits of the PAC revolution in campaign finance, and where labor and other traditional constituencies are in steep decline, the National Democratic Party has been driven to rely more than ever upon liberal Hollywood's combination of finance and fantasy. The money-grubbing pilgrimages of Democratic hopefuls to Malibu and Brentwood have become as important rites of presidential campaigning as the Iowa primary or even the convention itself. The Hollywood primary, as it were, has become the first, sometimes decisive, test of the sales potential of presidential timber in the face of the party's most important constituency of fundraisers and media managers. Locally, a veritable aqueduct of West Side entertainment and savings and loan money has irrigated the postmodern political machine run by Congressmen Berman, Waxman, and Levine. Recognized by the New Republic as the most powerful regional democratic grouping in the country, and operating with equal facility in local, state, and national arenas, Berman, Waxman, Levine, Incorporated are the most potent expression to date of the West Side's political ascendancy. Unlike old-fashioned machines, they do not depend on patronage resources or grassroots cadre. Instead, they rely upon a behind-the-scenes cold fusion of Hillcrest Country Club money, direct mail technology, and congressional seniority to promote the careers of protégés and allies. With the decline of the legendary Burton machine in the Bay Area, of which Assembly Speaker Brown is a veteran, BWL Inc. have become the potential kingmakers of California democracy. Current major subsidiaries include Minority Congressman Julian Dixon and Marty Martinez, State Senators Herschel Rosenthal and Gary Hart, as well as Assemblyman Bert Margolin and City Controller Rick Tuttle. Formerly chief allies of the Bradley regime, BWL Inc. have increasingly taken their distance from City Hall, identifying with the slow growth and anti-downtown discontent of the suburbs. Indeed, they were actively engaged in trying to overthrow Bradley, until the Times blew the whistle on the Koch-like strategy behind the campaign of West Side Councilmember Zev Yaroslavsky. The disclosure of a racist campaign memorandum written by Congressman Berman's legendarily uncouth brother Michael forced Yaroslavsky to fold his tents. Having gone to the brink of a split with Black Democrats, BWL Inc., responding to the anxiety of the entire West Side Jewish establishment, retreated instead. Also working the fast lanes of West Side power, often in tandem with BWL Inc., but sometimes in apparent opposition, are Manet, Phelps, Rothenberg, and Phillips, a major power center vaguely disguised as a law partnership. Charles Manet was the 1980s successor to two previous West Side corporate lawyers, Eugene Wyman and Paul Ziffrin, as Los Angeles's emissary in national democratic affairs. Serving from 1981 to 1985 as chairman of the Democratic National Committee, he created the Democratic Business Council to align the National Party more closely with the Business Roundtable's agenda, a strategy which, through the priority it attached to fiscal conservatism, helped to demolish Mondale's chances in 1984. Manet's firm continues to specialize in marriage counseling between Democrats and big business, especially the entertainment and real estate industries, while its partners interlock comprehensively and without scruple with virtually every Democratic notable or coterie in the city. Thus, in 1984, Manet associate Mickey Cantor, formerly Jerry Brown's chief L.A. operative, chaired Mondale's California campaign, while another Manet attorney, John Emerson, now chief deputy city attorney, ran Gary Hart's. This heads Manet wins, tails Manet wins strategy was repeated in 1988 during the controversy over Occidental Petroleum's attempt to legalize oil drilling on the shores of Santa Monica Bay. While Cantor extolled Armand Hammer's oil rigs as a revolt against West Side elitism, his colleague, Lisa Specht, represented angry homeowner and environmental groups with equal self-righteousness. Currently, Manet Phelps is supplying the major legal muscle to defend Mayor Bradley against sundry corruption and conflict of interest allegations, although it may be fairly surmised that the firm is also working to help groom his successor. The neoliberalism of BWL Inc. and the post-liberalism of Manet Phelps define the institutional parameters, as it were, of West Side Democratic power. But competitive fundraising still depends principally upon individual entrepreneurs or wealthy cliques. An important generational succession is taking place in Hollywood that echoes the larger recomposition of elites in the city. Fading from the scene, first of all, are the famous Malibu Mafia that engineered the election of Bradley in 1973 and then helped finance a stream of liberal victories in the aftermath of Watergate. Although Norman Lear is still kicking around, his energies have been long concentrated on People for the American Way, his antidote to moral majorities. Into the vacuum left by Pilevsky and Lear, meanwhile, have rushed baby boom glitzocrats, potentially powerful but colorlessly centrist young studio management from Fox, Disney, and New World, who were early backers of Dukakis in 1988. On their left flank is the Hollywood Women's Political Committee, which has molded part of the 1980s Brat Pack into an aggressive liberal feminist cadre. On the other end of Hollywood's political spectrum, Ron and Nancy survive in mummified splendor in Bel Air Estates, jointly financed by Japanese zaibatsu and federal taxpayers. The famous kitchen cabinet led by Justin Dart and Holmes Tuttle, however, has been whittled down by death and decrepitude. Even at its height in the late 1970s, it was strictly a venture capital operation around Reagan, with little impact as a local power structure. Ironically, the Reagan associate who remains politically most virile is his old agent, Lou Wasserman of MCA, now the supreme being of Democratic fundraising in Hollywood. Wasserman organizes the largest, nominally Democratic but anti-ideological camp of entertainment industry leaders. Generally speaking, the only cause for which they are willing to bleed is that of their studio's balance sheet. When Wasserman nods in any candidate's direction, they can trust that the rigorous bottom-line calculation has already been made. Although he and his Grand Vizier, Sidney Sheinberg, are mostly concerned with the impact of national politics on the entertainment industry, MCA, via ownership of Universal City, is the biggest real estate developer in the entire San Fernando Valley, and an active tentacle of the new octopus when it needs to be. But this entire constellation of power, old and new, revolves around historic Jewish and Democratic predominance in Hollywood, a fact that can no longer be taken for granted. Like downtown, Hollywood has been put on a global auction block. It is the software center of a madly evolving $150 billion world entertainment complex, growing 15% annually. The Economist estimates that nearly $100 billion has been invested in raiding and restructuring the industry since 1988. Locally, this has meant the offshore purchase of 4 out of 5 major recording companies and 4 out of 9 movie studios, as well as a flood of foreign capital into independent production and so-called mini-studios. If media raiders like Rupert Murdoch's Australian-based News Group, which bought Fox in 1985, are primarily looking for undervalued assets, the electronic hardware giants like Sony, which now owns CBS Records, Columbia, and TriStar, are creating vertically integrated entertainment monopolies for the millennium. The acquisition of Hollywood's dream machinery is a fitting capstone to Japanese capitalism's humbling of the United States in the age of Reagan and Bush. Although the ex-president, speaking in Tokyo, can praise the Zaibatsu for bringing a new rectitude to Babylon, no one can predict the implications of foreign ownership for the future of political fundraising in the studios, or for that matter, the industry's central role in national Jewish affairs. Like downtown, Hollywood is becoming a colony of the world economy.
誰が LAを動かしているか?
This is polite Japanese for, who rules LA? It is a question that will be increasingly asked by curious and confused newcomers, especially from societies where power remains organized in great dynastic hierarchies. Although Episcopalian bankers and San Marino debutantes on one side of town, and Hillcrest Country Club habitué on the other, will continue to dominate the local social register for another generation, biological echoes of the ruling classes of the 1880s, 1920s, and 1950s, real power is gravitating elsewhere. The stellar success of Los Angeles as a real estate media and technology mecca is overwhelming its traditional upper classes, diminishing their autonomy and clout. This is not to suggest that they are somehow being pauperized, indeed they are becoming wealthier, but rather that they are surrendering power, which is different from mere money, to others more strategically established in the new circuits of land monopoly and global finance. LA 2000, despite official hype about being the city of the 21st century, will largely be an entrepot for megabanks and technology monopolies headquartered elsewhere. It will also undoubtedly continue to be the urban equivalent of the Spanish Main for corporate buccaneers and notoria from all over the world. Its old waspish elites, especially, recumbent in their luxury, may linger primarily as consumers, compradores, or just breeding stock.